Thank you very much, Tim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on a Friday afternoon weekend. Just ahead of it's Friday, that means we talk to the people from Blue Sky Innovation at the Chicago Tribune. Meg Graham is in the studio today. Andrea Haynes, your editor.
Well-deserved vacation today.
Oh, she can't hear you. You don't have to say that.
It's well-deserved.
Bring that microphone a little closer to you. I'm glad that you're here because for a number of reasons. But one thing is I think you were one of the people responsible for this slideshow up online of the 50 most awesome things in Chicago tech offices. Now, we'll go through each slide one by one, and you can describe what you see.
So this is a really fun thing that I get to do every week, which is go to some of the companies that we cover and take a look through their offices. And tech offices are kind of notorious for trying to one-up each other in terms of the cool perks that they have and the kind of cool design that they have. So we've seen rooms that have hammocks in the conference rooms or, you know, catered meals or zip lines, tree
zip
houses.
Lines?
I mean, all sorts of
really?
Crazy stuff. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting because they have some money and they're sort of flaunting it the way they spend it on their offices, right?
Well, yeah. And part of it is that as people, as companies are trying to downsize their office space, they're trying to find other ways to give employees places to, you know, if you need to fire somebody, you don't want to do it out on an open office floor.
Right.
You want to have a private space where you can make a private phone call. So they're kind of downsizing private space and then increasing this amount of other types of space. So having a really cool cafeteria where you could eat, but you could also have a meeting or, you know, having different kinds of conference rooms that you can use for different kind of work.
I would imagine that tech companies are maybe more likely than others to have remote workers.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would mean a greater emphasis on public space rather than the cubicle hell.
Totally, yes. Some offices have places where if you do happen to be someone that works in different offices throughout the week or you do work at home, you can kind of touch down. They call it hoteling. So it is interesting to see how the way that millennials work, they kind of say this is driving a trend of offices that really accommodate people who might like to work at home 2 days a week or maybe like to travel or whatever.
Weird. So, you mean like offices that really value their workers?
Exactly.
That's bizarre. So do you see that? Do you see trends that come out of the tech industry expanding to offices in general?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of funny because I think you see things in Silicon Valley that maybe offices here are kind of starting to use. And then you have other kinds of offices, more traditional spaces saying, oh yeah, now we have open offices too. And our CEO sits out on the floor in more traditional offices. So it's interesting
and
to see.
And she hates it.
And yeah, I mean, usually they say they like it. They usually say, you know, I can listen in on what's happening and I'm more in the know than I ever was before. So,
well, you know, that is the downside of it because where I work, it's sort of communal upstairs in the newsroom. And so there is, if you need to make a phone call,
yeah,
you know, there really is no privacy.
Exactly. And that's the downside. But the upside is that you kind of hear what's going on. You're always kind of part of the conversation,
right, right.
I guess.
Exactly. So I hang up and they say, oh, did you call your doctor?
Exactly.
Is everything okay?
I know.
Speaking of doctors, there's also a story in Blue Sky about this startup, Regroup Therapy, which is a fascinating story to me. And it has to do with connecting therapists via Skype and other things like that. But the thing that stands out in it to me is this quote from the CEO, David Cohn. 55% of counties in the nation don't have any behavioral health providers in them. 55%.
I know.
That is an amazing number.
Yeah, so they're saying that this sort of use is really good for telehealth, which is basically health done, you know, using the internet or using Skype or using texting or whatever, because it's something that's relatively easy to do over Skype, right? So if you have a therapist or, you know, psychiatrist that needs to see a patient, instead of having to worry about driving around or finding someone that's close by, this is something you can do immediately. It's really easy.
And so this company pairs therapists with clinics around the country? Or how
exactly,
does
yeah. So they have a network of 2,000 doctors. And then if a primary care provider says, you know, oh, it's so hard for us to find, you know, a behavioral health specialist, instead of having to find them and hire them, they can use Regroup to get a team of people that will be on demand for them when they need them. So if someone comes in and they really need to see a behavioral, you know, a psychiatrist, psychologist, they can say, okay, we're going to walk you into this room. We'll introduce you via, it's kind of like Skype. It's not exactly Skype. And then you can do the consultation and then just check out like you normally would.
It's interesting that they have to come. It's better for the patients to actually do it in their own doctor's office? Is that strictly for insurance?
Or? It's for insurance. It's also, you know, if you're prescribing drugs, you need to take vital signs and things like that. So if you have someone in there, the nurse can do it. Also, then they can just chart all that stuff directly into the EMR. It just kind of improves communication.
Right.
And then, yeah, for insurance reasons, too.
I wonder if a psychologist or psychiatrist, I mean, obviously it's better to have one remotely than not one at all.
Yeah.
But it's surprising to me that they say it can do it just as well. Because I would think that someone who's studying someone's behavior, there's so much more about tone and body language and the way they carry themselves that you might not see on the computer as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. And it maybe depends on the person, depends on, you know, the specialist.
Sure.
You know, maybe there are people that would prefer to see people. But I think, like you said, better to have somebody there than nobody at all.
Yeah, it's amazing that 55% of the counties, I mean, that's just you know, just to go on, I didn't finish that, but the quote says, he says, that's not a social worker, not a psychiatrist, nothing. It's a huge mm-hmm. problem.
And it's interesting, too. He said that in Cook County, which, you know, we do have a lot of those providers, but maybe people can't afford them. They can't travel to meet with someone. So there's also kind of a gap in shortage in services here, too.
And so are these therapists, are they all around the country? Are they based here in Chicago?
Most of it's in Illinois at this point. So
right.
This kind of new funding that they just raised, that's kind of going to be used to spread out to other states.
And it's kind of a nice thing. We talked about working from home.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can be a therapist in Wyoming 1 minute and Oregon the next.
Exactly. Well,
while you live in Buffalo Grove.
Yeah. Well, there's some laws that restrict, you know, where you can do consultations if you're a physician in one state, but I think there's lots of telehealth laws that are changing how that all looks.
So we're talking about health, and there's a company in Evanston called Aptinix.
Aptinix, yes.
I did it, huh?
You did it.
They raised $65 million for a neurological disorder drug. Tell me about that.
Okay, so this company is really interesting. They've had so much happen in the last couple of years. So they spun out of research that was done at Northwestern. That company became Norex, and then they developed two drugs for depression that were actually acquired by Allergan, which is a major drug company, for $560 million last year.
Wow.
So when that happened, Norex was acquired by them, Aptinix spun out, and so it uses the same technology and the same sort of chemistry and IP and all that to develop new drugs.
So interesting thing. So they spun out, and so they could have chosen any name they wanted. And they went with Aptinix.
It does sound kind of like a brain.
I guess it does, yeah. Meg Gimbel from Blue Sky Innovation, thanks for coming
Thank
in today.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate it. And will we see you next week? Or there's a revolving chair now, I think, that Andrea's out.
Yeah, we'll see. I'm not sure if she's back next week.
We'll pressure her to come back early. This is the Business Lunch on 720. It's 12:23. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Tom Gimbel is in the studio, the principal behind the LaSalle Network. And Tom, I want to start.
Yep.
We're going to talk a little bit about kids and going to college or getting out of college, right?
Yep.
I want to give a little shout out to the Deerfield High School boys gymnastics team, because they are maybe right about now making their way down to Hinsdale for the state finals.
You know what? I'm a Highland Park guy right next door. I didn't even realize it.
They share teams, the Highland Park and Deerfield.
A lot of them, yeah.
And so my son, Noah, is going to do the vault today in the state finals.
Congratulations. That's fantastic.
Great, team, great group of guys. So
that's great.
Good luck to those kids. All right, let's talk about 4 years from now when my son is trying to get a job.
Assuming he doesn't take a gap year going off of our topic last week.
Right. I am not the president of the United States, and he will not be taking a gap year. But I will be desperate for him to get a job.
Yep.
And sometimes parents get a little too involved, don't they?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things that I see, and I'm not saying that it doesn't work at times, but if you want your kid to be self-sufficient, you want them to get a job, you don't need to call your friends. You give your kid the name, and your kid calls.
See, I was thinking of that this morning, and I didn't know what we were going to talk about. I'm coming in, and my daughter is in between sophomores. She's a rising junior, I guess you refer
yep.
to it. And I was thinking of her in internships, and one of my first thoughts was, I got to step up. I got to hook her up with an internship.
You need to give. She needs to have the initiative to think about who your friends and associates are and to call them. So I had a friend of mine from the suburbs. His kid was in between freshman and sophomore year in college down at U of I, and he wanted to ask me for help. So the guy calls me up, and he says, hey, would you talk to my son? I said, sure, I'll talk to him. So he calls me up, and he goes, any other advice for me? The kid says this at the end, really nice, polite, totally great kid.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yeah. I said, I've met you 30 times. You didn't need your dad to call me to ask if you could call me.
Interesting.
I go, you could call me.
And so you think that the, so if my kids know someone I know.
If your kid doesn't, your kid calls me and right. says, I've never met your daughter before. She says, hey, it's Steve. He sends me an email. Subject, Steve Bertrand. Hi, we haven't met. You know my dad from doing the radio. I'm looking for an internship. Would you be possible to talk to you for a little bit?
That counts more for you than if I had said, hey.
Absolutely.
Really?
I'd still do it for you, but it shows me I'd rather hire the kid who calls me directly.
Yeah, it's a good advice.
That's the initiative.
And that's something that just had not ever occurred to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I can give them or a parent can give the kids the names.
Oh, my dad, when I graduated from college, he gave me a list of like 20 guys. And he said, call these people. Well, one of them he just met like the day before, and I call the guy thinking it's like my dad's best friend. I don't even know who the guy is.
You know what? That happened to me, too. I went to a South Suburban newspaper, and a friend of a friend said, oh, this guy, the sports editor at the paper, is a great friend of mine.
Right.
Stop by and say hello.
He didn't know him.
He had no idea. And here's I'm a college kid looking at this
Absolutely.
Guy. All right. So the other thing, then, is to be realistic about, because here's the thing. They get out of school. You want them to jump right in the career path. And you want them to get the best job possible. Sometimes it's not going to be what your view of the best job is.
Right. It's not. It is absolutely not what you think it is. And, you know, so many parents I talk to, they think their kid's going to graduate, especially our listening audience from the Big Ten schools or Notre Dame or whatever. Right? Oh, my kid's going to go to work at Goldman. No, she's not.
Right.
She's not going to work at Goldman. She's not going to work at Goldman Gym Shoes, right? And she can get a job doing entry-level sales, doing inside marketing work, doing whatever it is. It's to get experience and to figure out what she wants to do for her life.
And I think the mistake I will make is applying the experience that I had 35 years ago when I was entering the job market and thinking it still applies today.
It's a different world. I think the best thing you can do is hopefully you have the relationship with your kid where they come to you and they go, Dad, I've got two jobs I'm getting offered. What do you think? And then you can look at them and say, well, let's look long term and let's look short term. Because short term, well, one job pays $35,000 and one pays $30,000. Well, when you're 22 years old, $5,000 seems like a lot.
Right.
Right? But the $30,000 a year job may give you such a breadth of experience that 3 years from now, one's paying you $90 and one's paying you $50.
The key is that they're going to be doing it with any luck for a long time.
Exactly. And be good at it and be happy.
And the first job is important, but it's not going to be the last job.
No, so get as much experience as you can versus short-term dollars.
Tom Gimbel from the LaSalle Network, LaSalleNetwork.com.
You got it.
All right. Good to see you again.
Thanks for having me.
Have a great weekend.
You too.
This is a Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thank you, Kim Gordon. You're listening to the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, why is it some people are more willing to take risks than others? Is it courage? Is it folly? Maybe just simple biology. Kate Sukel is looking at that in her book called The Art of Risk, and she joins us in the studio this afternoon. Kate, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
So you sort of undertook this project when you found yourself becoming more risk adverse?
Yes. I'd always thought that a lot of my success, both as a self-employed person and even when I was in the business world, was because I was a risk taker. And all of a sudden I hit 40 and instead of getting a boy toy and a Corvette, I ended up with a nice, reliable station wagon and I joined the PTO. And it made me wonder, what is risk exactly?
It's natural though, isn't it, as we get older?
Well, that's the thing, right? So they do suggest that it's natural, right? We know better. We have better experience. And yet, a lot of the science is saying we'd be a lot better off if we didn't automatically fall into those habits and say no. It's not that we're so much better experience. It's just we get really in a rut.
Interesting. So the science doesn't lend itself toward less risk-taking as we get older. It's just our routines that do so.
Yeah. So basically, if we really distill it down what the brain does, it's a prediction machine. It's trying to predict what's coming next so that we can hopefully survive, if not thrive.
That's why we don't touch the stove twice.
Yes. Well, at least hopefully
or
not.
Or four times, right?
Or eight times, right. Yes. But so when risk comes around, basically the brain wants to take a lot of shortcuts. It's trying to figure out what's happening next and makes a lot of jumps. And so by the time we get that experience, it can make us take shortcuts that are not necessarily in our best possible interest. They'll keep us safe, but not necessarily happy.
I'm interested in the idea because when we think of risk-taking, we think of maybe jumping out of an airplane or, you know, speeding down a highway or doing something sort of stupid.
Mm-hmm.
But you write, and I hadn't thought of it until you did, that almost every decision is risk in one way or another.
Yeah, and in fact, I mean, there's that old line about nothing is certain but death and taxes.
Right.
But you don't know how you're going to die, and you never can figure out how much you're actually going to owe Uncle Sam every year. So really, uncertainty is part of every single decision you make every single day. And it's those that we don't even think that much about, whether or not to have that third cup of coffee, even though you know it might give you the jitters later, or whether you're working on that, you know, million-dollar business deal.
So whether to have that third cup of coffee can be considered a decision with risk?
Yes, because you don't know what the effects will be. You might be just fine, or it might totally mess you up later.
All right, tell me the difference then, or the, how the relationship is from science to society when it comes to decision making?
Really, I think we talk about risk in extremes, and you just hinted at that. We want to make it the stuff of our superheroes, extreme sports, of course, our heroes in the business world. But really, it's a decision making process that each of us makes each and every day. And what's great about that is that it means all of us can harness it for our own success. And that means, you know, some of us, of course, we have that drive. We are in those boardrooms. We are jumping out of planes. Some of us are just trying to make things a little bit better for ourselves at home.
Yeah, well, you know, I love talking to you about this because I think the riskiest decision I make is whether to drive in or take the train.
You know, statistically speaking, you know, if driving on the freeway in a car, that's really risky.
Yeah, but my point is that I'm very boring. You know, that the life is that I have settled, you know, and I'm not doing mm-hmm. that. So what you're saying is that if you start to rethink things, that you can sort of become that risk taker again.
Well, you ask yourself, why are you saying no? And a lot of times, you know, you ask yourself, would the cost really be too much to bear? The answer is no.
Right.
We just sort of get in the habit of saying no, and we want to tell ourselves, oh, we're experienced, we know better, there's too much at stake. But in reality, you know what? The cost probably wouldn't be too great, and you might get a lot of interesting stuff about it. A novel experience, it's good for the brain, some joy, some fun, meet new people, network.
The safe decision can become the dangerous one.
Indeed it can.
Tell me about, is there actually a risk-taking gene? Have they found such a thing?
So they've actually found several genes that have been linked to risk-taking behaviors, but they tend to be linked to your more negative risk-taking behaviors. So if you're interested in being arrested and being incarcerated or becoming a drug addict, those are kind of the genes that are involved. But there are also some that look at making optimal decisions under risk. And what's interesting is they seem to be more linked about self-serving decisions. So things that are going to help you as a person do better as opposed to the group or society or whatever.
So you might have a gene. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I mean, I would say there are probably hundreds of genes. And for any complex behavior, there are always going to be 100 genes that contribute to that behavior. But what's really interesting is when you start to distill down, that one little change in your gene, over time, you know, what it means is you're running a different algorithm for risk-taking. You calculate the odds a little bit differently. And over time, that means a very different life lived.
I was talking to Angela Duckworth, who has a book out.
Yes, Grit. Yeah, fascinating.
And we were talking about this idea that, you know, the thing about grit is that you can develop it yourself and you can accomplish great things with grit.
Right.
And we tend to give ourselves an excuse by saying, well, she's got great talent or he's mm-hmm. got natural talent, and that's something I could never do.
We do the same thing with risk-taking.
Well, that's what
we
I wonder.
He's
yeah.
a risk-taking, she's a risk-taker. I could never do what they do. And the truth is, what's interesting is the reason why they're so good and they look so successful is because they're so well-versed in their domain. They are so thoughtful and they're so prepared. And they know, they basically can minimize the uncertainty.
Risk-takers are prepared.
Oh, yes, they are. It was amazing. Across every, so in the book I interview a Wall Street guy turned professional poker player, Steph Davis, who's a world-renowned base jumper and free solo climber, a neurosurgeon, a serial entrepreneur. And it was funny because they all kept saying the same things about risk. And it was basically like, I don't think I'm a risk taker. They sounded like, you know, your agoraphobic Aunt Millie saying, I don't really think what I do is risky. But why that is because they know their area so well. They know it inside and out. And so they really can manage the uncertainty to a point where they're very comfortable.
All right, this is a business show.
Yes.
So if you're hiring, mm-hmm. do you want to hire risk takers or do you want to avoid risk takers?
Okay, so you want to avoid impulsive people, fly by the seat of their pants people who think that they can charm themselves into a deal. What you want are thoughtful and seasoned risk takers, those people that are going to do the work, who are going to learn that particular deal inside out and figure out how to move forward. You need to give people room to innovate, and that is risk taking in one sense, but you want to make sure that they're doing it in the smart way and not the, you know, hey, everybody watch me kind of way.
Right. And so is there a way to, how do you know?
I think you ask them some questions about how they would approach uncertainty. And if they're telling you, well, then I'd learn what I can about it. I'd talk to other people in the field. I'd do my homework. I'd get prepared before I jump. I'd learn from my mistakes. I think that's a person you want to hire. If you want somebody who's going to say, you know, hey, I'm winning. Look at me. I win all the time. I beat China all the time.
Well, those are the two variables, right? Because you've got the one guy who's saying, look at me. Is an extreme on the negative end, right? Mm-hmm. And then on the other extreme, on the other negative end, if there can be, is the non-risk taker who says, oh, please don't look at me.
Right. But let me do the work. Let me show you how. Behind every, you know, sort of show off, that the face of the deal, there are five guys, the real risk takers, that are standing behind him that have done the work, that have educated him and gotten him to that point where he could get that deal done.
All right. One quick piece of advice then for those of us who are a little too safe in our decision making. How do we break out of that?
I think it comes down to being more thoughtful, taking a step back and asking yourself, why am I saying no? What am I really scared of? And if I did go ahead with this, would the loss really be too great to bear? And I would probably 75% of the time, the answer is no. And just think of all the great experience you can get from taking that risk and learning something new.
Tate Sukul is the author of the book, The Art of Risk, The New Science of Courage, Caution, and Chance. And I'm going to add ... in the workplace because it applies.
It does.
Nice to talk to you. Thanks very much for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
You bet. You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thank you, Ori. In 12:51, this is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. I'm glad you listen. Appreciate that. You can always follow me on Facebook at Steve Bertrand or on Twitter at Steve Bertrand as well. I was reading the Chicago Tribune the other day, and I see the name of Scott Catoon. He's the host of Tomorrow's Business Today. That's a podcast you can hear at WGNplus.com. He's been on the program before. Turns out he is a Marquette boy. So another plus there, and he's back in the studio with us today. Scott, welcome back.
Thank you very much for having me, Steve.
And the reason you're on the studio in the show today is because of this Tribune article where you have taken over Technori.
That's correct.
Which seems like a pretty good fit for you, but explain for me first what Technori is. Just what Technori is.
So Technori is actually the third largest monthly startup showcase in the country. And it's basically five startup companies come on for 5 minutes and talk about sort of what their business and why. And it's uniquely different from anything else of its kind, pitch-wise or startup pitch or venture pitch that exists, because we don't focus on the money. We don't focus on projections and things that will change almost certainly immediately. We focus on sort of your mission and your ethos. What are you? What is your company? What's your product? And why are you here? Why should I care?
So you focus more on what's behind the idea than the idea, or what's around the idea?
Well, no, I mean, it's still the idea. The companies come out and they tell us, like, here's what we're doing. We're going to, you know, build an app that does this. And the reason that we're doing it is this, and who we're going to impact is this. And this is why it's important to you. The difference is that normally when you go to a venture pitch or any sort of startup pitch, the only thing they talk about, they give you like 30 seconds on their idea.
I see, right.
And then it's just like, oh, well, and we're trying to raise $150,000 at seven, you know, whatever. And it just, it's kind of icky sometimes, and this is different.
You know, it's kind of what strikes me as you describe it. I mean, I'm aware of these things that happen all the time, but it's almost like reality TV has come to the stage.
It very much is. And for the people on stage, it's very real because companies who have been on Technori's stage have raised over $265 million.
And so who's in the audience? Investors?
You know what? It's 500 or so people usually, and it's a complete mixture of entrepreneurs, people who just are really interested in technology and science, kind of nerdy, whatever.
Right.
Lots of high school kids.
It's your idea of a Saturday night out, right?
Yeah. I mean, hey, if it's your... I will make it your ideal Saturday night. It's going to be a good time. But yeah, it's there's some investors, there's a lot of business owners, there's a lot of kids that are interested in technology and just want to know what's going on. A lot of entrepreneurs. It's really a mixed bag.
You know, we talk so much about innovation districts and technology districts and all of that. In a way, that's just a little pod.
Yeah.
Of people to network and get to know other people.
Well, ironically enough, of the group, normally about 300 or so are there waiting for the doors to open beforehand, about 6:30, and they all sort of pool, and there is a networking event that we actually do during that time.
Oh, yeah,
the show.
Right. Makes perfect sense.
Exactly. And then afterward, they actually go to another networking thing, which is at the Rosebud right now, and we'll see how long that stays there.
So
but it's, yeah.
This was the brainchild of Seth Kravitz, right?
That's
brought
correct.
It out, and you are buying it from him?
We're calling it a merger. There's, you know, the financial terms we can't disclose, but it's
no,
more of a
merger. No, you can disclose them. Go ahead.
Yeah.
We're interested. We want to know.
Well, I'm sure the lawyers would love this. My phone's ringing already.
But what strikes me is, and maybe I read this wrong, but the idea came because you had Kravitz on your podcast.
Yep. So I had him on. He was one of the first guests that I had on the second set of shows that I did, and he was talking about what they wanted to do, what he envisioned for the future. And in my mind, I was going, man, I'm chasing after that same vision. And we just sort of had conversations offline, and it just seemed like maybe I'm the one who should carry on the torch as we go forward. There's more passion and more want, and he has some things that he wants to get back in the startup community and just see.
Well, that's he was quoted as saying almost exactly that in the Tribune about how, you know, it needs a little fire.
Yep.
And maybe his fire is moving in a different direction, and he thinks you can provide it.
I hope I can. I think I've said to a lot of people who've emailed about Technori and the changeover that the future is going to be really cool. It's going to be, you know, pump it up, make it more energy, and there'll be some new changes that we add to Technori to make it more fun. One being the podcast you mentioned, Tomorrow's Business Today, is going to be rebranded Technori. So now, if you're interested in startups and innovation, you can tune in almost daily and get more stuff from Technori.
So you've killed Tomorrow's Business Today?
For right now, I'm putting a pause on it.
Yeah.
I don't want to say kill it because there's actually...
But you've renamed it in a way.
I'm renaming it for sure.
Yeah.
But there is... I've had some interest from other podcasters. Like 6 or 7 tech podcasts have popped up since I started Tomorrow's Business Today,
uh-huh,
who've reached out and said, hey, you know, would you be interested in having Technori host 4 or 5 different tech podcasts? If that's the case, then maybe Tomorrow's Business Today might have just a new host.
That's nice. And so I know Technori is already in a few other cities. They've got an event in Milwaukee coming up. Is that the sort of thing you're going to expand it further?
Yeah, there's going to be some expanding. They've been in Milwaukee successfully, in Atlanta, Dubuque, Los Angeles. We're going to be in Milwaukee again in June. In July, we're going to be in New York, and we have plans to expand in Bangalore, India, Kiev, and Lagos in
Wow.
Africa. The expansion is going to be swift once I get it, you know, kind of back online. We're going to still have our planned expansion, but I think there'll be some subtle changes, and we're going to really refine and tighten up our package, and then it's going to be gangbusters.
Well, Seth was right. You're fired up, ready to go.
I'm fired up, man.
How do people get more information?
You can go to technori.com, TechNori.com. Follow us on Twitter, Technori. Follow me on Twitter at Katun, KITUN.
Scott Katun, thanks very much. And we can listen to you as well at WGNplus.com.
Absolutely.
Thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN.